Where is west of 98?
West of 98 is west of the 98th meridian, which is the isohedral line, beyond which or west of which there's less than 20 inches of rainfall, meaning it's a region of aridity. And you need to irrigate your crops in order to raise anything worth eating. And it has been customarily considered where the West begins and the East and Midwest end.
And it was also sort of an homage to Wallace Stegner's book, Beyond the 100th Meridian. We wanted to just sort of echo that thought.
This is The Right Question, a literary program that features writers from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman. I have two guests this time, Lynn Stegner and Russell Rowland. They're the co-editors of West of 98, Living and Writing the New American West. Lynn Stegner is on the phone. She's the author of three novels and a novella. She's also written short stories, poems, and essays, and has taught fiction writing at a number of universities, including Stanford. On the long list of her honors and awards is a Fulbright Scholarship to Ireland and a Raymond Carver Short Story Award. Russell Rowland is the author of two novels, In Open Spaces, which made the San Francisco Chronicle's bestseller list and was named among the best of the West by the Salt Lake City Tribune, and The Watershed Years, a finalist for the High Plains Book Award. Rowland has an MA in creative writing from Boston University, and he's taught at various institutions. In 2007, he returned to his native Montana, and he now teaches at MSU Billings and does private writing consultation. Let's begin with your vision for the book. Lynn, what were you looking for when you asked writers to submit pieces?
Well, we began with a somewhat modest idea of just a handful, perhaps a dozen writers, talking about what it means to be a Westerner. And then Russell and I decided to get a little grand and come up with something that was more defining, and that had partly to do with the fact that we were one decade into the 21st century, and we thought we're standing on a kind of time fulcrum, and we could look backward and forward and think about who we are as a region and who we might become as a region. And with that sort of congeries of situations, we decided, let's do something really definitive. And that meant sending letters out to members of the, most of the significant members of the literary tribe, and saying, look, we want you to talk about what it means to be where you're from. And those people then got excited about the idea and suggested other people that hadn't occurred to us. And we ended up with something like 67 writers that created what we called a kind of Greek chorus, who could remark and comment upon their own specific place as an individual's experience and how it translated to the regional experience of being a Westerner.
Basically, what we had in mind was sort of just taking an inventory of where people are as far as the Western identity now. And we wanted it to be as personal as possible, like she said, and we didn't want an academic exploration of the West, but more of a more of these people's personal thoughts about what's important today in the West.
Russell, your essay titled Chasing the Lamb includes this comment: the West has long suffered from an inferiority complex. So is that why we're always trying to explain ourselves to outsiders? I'm just wondering if other areas in the United States spend as much time trying to define who they are as we do.
It probably does apply to a lot of other regions as well. But I think when you look at the history of the West as a region, we've been particularly hard-pressed to sort of gain any respect as in terms of our art and cultural contributions. So that was a recurring theme for sure in a lot of the pieces. And I think, going back to Wallace Stegner's book, Angle of Repose, when it was released and the New York Times decided not to review it until it won the Pulitzer Prize, you know, that's a pretty good example of how hard it's been to sort of get the respect of the Eastern elite in terms of our culture and what we have to contribute.
Oh.
Yeah.
The West is like every other place on Earth, always going through cycles of invasion by outsiders, beginning with Native tribes. And a few of the essays in West of 98 speak to the issue of wealthy people building second or third or fourth homes in some of our most beautiful and isolated places. Lynn, is there a particular essay or essays in the book that give us some insight into this issue?
You're making me go to the table of contents and sort of think about this. Of course, Douglas Unger's piece about Las Vegas, which is the quintessential playground, and it's become a playground, a global playground, and it's unashamedly so. On the other hand, Las Vegas isn't anymore a naturally beautiful place. It's become a human landscape rather than a natural landscape. One of the natural resources of the West, in addition to oil and timber and in some cases water, is its beauty. So it is a resource. We're opportunistic about it because the tourism helps support an economy. The economy is spread out because the landscape is arid and it is an oasis civilization with large cities spaced by hundreds and hundreds of miles, and it is finally a function of the landscape itself.
Well, lest people think that this is an academic publication, it absolutely isn't. And I'm thinking right now of the piece called Ranching in Suburbia,
yes,
where there was a suburb built next to a ranch, and the neighbor who lived in the suburb called up the ranchers and wanted him to stop the cows from mooing. And
yeah, that was the one I was thinking of, too. Also, Jonas Agee's piece, she talks very eloquently, I thought, about the struggle that we have within ourselves to come to terms with these people coming into our space, you know, how you kind of want to have your own space and be alone, but you also have to recognize that you have to be a good neighbor too. And she talks about one day she looked out and her neighbors were playing football in her yard, so she put some shrubs up the next day and felt guilty about it.
Right. Well, Russell, you wrote about how myths of the West, particularly the stereotypical strong, silent, independent cowboy character, affected your childhood. And there's a passage I'd like you to read in your essay, Chasing the Lamb. That's about that. It starts on page 103.
Okay. One winter day when I was still a teenager, my Uncle Lee and I were driving around the ranch when we saw a herd of deer in the distance. I'd never shot a deer, and my uncle suggested this would be a good time. He had a rifle in the pickup, so we made our way around the perimeter and positioned ourselves in the direction they were traveling. I had very little shooting experience, so I missed my first few attempts. I started to get frustrated and embarrassed, which only made me more determined. With one shell left in the rifle, we finally headed off the herd at just the right angle. They came bounding gracefully in front of us. I jumped from the pickup, propped the rifle against my narrow shoulder, and fixed my sights on the closest deer. I fired, and to my surprise, she dropped. My uncle circled the truck, laughing and cheering, and threw his arms around me, but I was fighting back a sick feeling in my stomach. I couldn't reconcile how beautiful that animal had looked racing across the pasture and how I'd crumpled that same beauty in an instant. I've never been opposed to hunting, but I've never done it again. Of course, I'm not the first kid to feel this way about hunting. Maybe most hunters experience that initial reaction and keep doing it anyway. But I think this experience symbolizes a common struggle among Westerners, the fight between what we're expected to be and what we really are, the question of whether we embrace Western attitudes because we believe in them or because we feel compelled to fit in, and the fact that some of the qualities that are attributed to us apply, but some don't. In many ways, this is no different from the experience of teenage boys anywhere. The pressure to fit in inspires idiotic behavior and angst for teenagers all over the world. But in the capital W West, everything is magnified by legend and by myth. We have a reputation to uphold, and that's not always a good thing for confused teenage boys or for grown men and women. For example, when I started drinking, I took the job damn seriously, and my genetic makeup combined with the underlying pressure to be a real Western man sent me on a short but dramatic journey into a treatment program. What I finally wonder is whether the last frontier of the West might be the internal journey, this search for how each of us fits into this mythical place. From as far back as I can remember, there was an underlying feeling that growing up here meant that we shouldn't expect to be as sophisticated as those exotic folks to the East, or even the ones on our own coast. The idea of going to an Ivy League school never entered my mind in high school, but I later realized that I had the credentials to attend just about any college I wanted. The West has long suffered from an inferiority complex. Westerners have been reminded in ways that are often subtle, but always clear, that we are interesting in some of the same ways that cavemen or headhunters are interesting. We are reminders of a past that was brutal and lawless. And we are often expected to perpetuate these myths, making occasional appearances in the press for our modern-day outlaws, our mountain men, our Unabomber, and producing art that reflects the same old stereotypes. We constantly struggle with the possibility that if we step out of these roles, we might not be taken seriously. And yet we're not taken seriously when we stick with the roles either. Even those of us who have achieved success in our artistry are considered regional and are often dismissed. In a sense, it's understandable that we hang on to the myths, or perhaps address the myths from a slightly different angle, because the myths are interesting, and because the relationship between the past and the present is always part of a region's history. We do have a violent history, and it's important to acknowledge how this affects the people who live here today. We are descended from people who were shaped by labor, people who could fix just about anything if you gave them enough time. But there are also those among us who have traveled the globe, lived in cities, and have just as broad a perspective as any Easterner. The more places I've lived, the more I realize the old adage that my people are really no different from people anywhere. But what is different is that Westerners have a history that is as hard to overlook as a 10-gallon hat. We know that the wild, wild West, where men were tough as nails and women were just as tough but looked good in gingham, is a myth, but not entirely.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Lynn Stegner and Russell Rowland. They're co-editors of a new collection of essays and poetry titled West of 98, Living and Writing the New American West. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about fresh starts and hear a couple of passages from the book. Don't go away. Larry Watson noted that Western myths refuse to die, no matter how many times they're exposed. And Larry McMurtry writes, quote, "Lies about the West are more important to readers than truths." Lynn, do you think that's true?
I do. And just because we're human beings, that is to say, it's important to us as a species to hang on to or cling to some sense of our biological wildness. And the West represents that, not just to us as the rest of the nation, but to the world. I mean, there are reasons why Western films, for instance, are popular in Italy, in Russia, in other countries, and it's because it represents some part of our nature that we are loath to relinquish, and to imagine a place where we can retain some sense of being unbound by rules, by society, by sidewalks and streetlights and corrective signage. It's essential to us. And it isn't just that. It's also simply the space that aridity prescribes. And that space, as I was talking about in my introduction, represents a kind of room to breathe and room to imagine the unimaginable or to envision some kind of better life. And so the West is so symbolic, not to just to us as a nation, but I remember going to a national park recently in Utah, outside of Moab, three national parks, in fact, and I heard not English, but German, Italian, and French from other hikers and tourists. These people are coming here to remember what it's like to be a creature upon the planet.
Do you think a fresh start is also part of our heritage? We're always looking for some way to leave our past and our mistakes behind and get out there where possibilities are huge.
Yes, definitely. A fresh start. That's a good phrase. Yeah, we all need a new dartboard, and the West looks big enough. And it looks big because of, again, the aridity. You can't build places where there isn't any water. And so there's a lot of big gaps between cities and settlements. And so it looks possible. It isn't, but it looks possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have built a lot of cities where there wasn't any water. We just piped it in from somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
but that's a discussion for another book and another day. Russell, I'd like to go back to your essay and have you read again, okay, starting at Life in the Old West.
All right. Life in the Old West was sometimes a thrilling adventure, but it was mostly just brutal. Suicide rates were and still are high, and rates of alcoholism and mental illness would have been just as high if anyone had acknowledged them. There was very little that was romantic about life in those early days, whether you were a cowboy, a farmer, an Indian, or a miner. Work was persistent and strenuous. Minorities and women were treated like pack animals. People lived in constant fear of the elements, of disease, and fear of the scores of ruffians who found their way west. Deserters from the Civil War, problem children from wealthy Eastern families, and garden variety outlaws all found safe haven in the West, where the law was often as lawless as they were. And in many areas, the lack of water was a scourge. Among other things, it made personal hygiene difficult, which invited disease. The real West was a children's graveyard. It was a series of misguided schemes that drew people in hordes, from the Gold Rush to the Homestead Act, to outrageous propaganda from the railroads. It was ranch hands frozen in snowdrifts trying to escape the relentless wind. It was senseless slaughter by both whites and natives fighting for what they thought they deserved. And it was bad information. Nobody told the pioneers that 160 acres of this land, the amount available through the original Homestead Act, couldn't possibly support a family because there just wasn't enough water. Nobody told them how hard it would be to live in a shack in winters that reached 40 below zero, or that the worst part was not the cold, but the isolation of living miles from the nearest neighbor in a tiny, poorly constructed house. For every Annie Oakley, there were thousands of widows left with a house full of hungry children. For every William Clark who found wealth in the copper mines of Montana, thousands of men died in mining disasters because of the lack of safety standards. For every publicity hound like George Armstrong Custer, thousands of cavalrymen died fighting for land that meant nothing to them. And for every John Clay who made a fortune running cattle, thousands of anonymous cowpunchers quietly fought their loneliness by drinking themselves to death in isolated bunkhouses. The people in the West learned not to talk about their problems because life was hard for everyone, and you didn't want to be the one to complain. A grieving mother didn't mention the baby she'd lost the week before, because four other women in the room had lost a child in the past year. Not only that, but part of you believed you deserved it for having been hoodwinked into coming out west in the first place. There was a core of guilt and shame that lived in the hearts of those early Westerners. We stole this land, and for the vast majority, what we got in return wasn't exactly bountiful. It's easy to spot a guilty unease in the self-effacing attitude of most Westerners. It sounds bleak, but here's the important part of the story. Despite all of it, the deceit and the loneliness, the guilt and the fear, many of us stayed. We're still here. So what was it about this place that made people stay against all odds, despite the broken promises? What held people fast to the dry Montana dirt? What was it about the badlands of South Dakota that kept people pushing their team into one more blizzard to pitch one more wagon load of hay for their cattle? One answer, of course, is that many of them couldn't afford to leave. Most of the early pioneers gave up everything they had to come west and establish lives here. They had no money left. But there had to be more to it than that for many of these early settlers. Was it the direct connection to the land, the majesty of the mountains, the quiet drama of the open prairie? Or was it the people, the country dances, the card parties every Friday night, the fact that neighbors showed up at 5 in the morning to help with the branding, to raise your barn, or to help dock your lambs? Was it the fact that everyone within 5 miles hauled barrels of water and gunny sacks to your ranch to fight a fire in the buttes? It was all of these things, the shared experience, both of the brutality and the joy. The satisfaction of watching your very own cattle get fat from the rich prairie grasses. It was the feeling I got when I was 16, riding alone in a pasture where I could neither see nor hear anyone for miles, where I could smell the sweet and sour sagebrush and hear the twittering melody of the meadowlarks. I could admire the rows of hay I'd cut the day before. I recognized the ewe I'd pulled from the bog, the one with the twisted horn, and knew that if I hadn't found her, she'd still be there, long dead. That was also part of the real West. But for many of us, it no longer is. I never worked on a ranch again, despite the power of that experience. The new West is filled with people who've never been on a horse, people who wouldn't know a baler from a cultivator. The new West has people who oppose hunting and don't eat the red meat that has provided a living for so many of our families and towns, people who prefer a latte to a shot of whiskey. It has become more and more like any other place, with Walmarts and Costcos and towns that were once considered insignificant by big business. So what does living in the West mean today?
That is really a huge question. And yeah. I applaud both of you for taking it on with this book. It's something that people can read, I would think, for months and have discussions in book clubs and never get to the end of what there is to talk about on the different perspectives that you've put forth for us.
Well, that's kind of what I was hoping for, was just to start a discussion, because I think it is a valuable conversation.
So, Lynn, let's end with you reading a little bit from the introduction to the book.
All right. Well, I'll actually read the conclusion to the introduction, which is, which in a way sort of concludes the book to a certain extent. With each successive crop of stewards, the West does gain a little. It was never intelligence we lacked. It was information, or perhaps more honestly, belief in that information. There are still those, for instance, who will not accept the data that establishes the reality of climate warming or climate disruption, as Paul Ehrlich insists we call it so that it doesn't sound so cozy. But we have not yet drawn even with our environmental consequences. We're like a man running uncontrollably downhill, trying to catch up with his own momentum. Falling is likely. Surviving is in question. Because of history and a shattering evidentiary record, we know now truly that the West is arid. And on the human sensory level, we can feel that knowledge of aridity in the sear wind against our skin and taste it in the alkali water, and to steal a line from Ursula Le Guin, smell it in the holy sage that purifies. We can hear it in the windy silence of a seasonal wash or in the roar of a spring flash flood, chocolate-colored and bristling with debris as it barrels down a slick rockside canyon into the San Juan or the Yampa or the Colorado River. Mostly, though, as a vision-based species, we see aridity. Of all the senses that the West stimulates, it is sight that enlarges even while it falters and loses itself across the landscape. loses as it gathers up the bigness and the mystery of the space that aridity defines. Even in its seeming cure, you can see the aridity in the rain that doesn't reach the ground, those sooty veils of Virga that patter down from skies boiling with late summer weather. The space itself suggests a kind of primordial virginity, as though here across these limitless plains in these improbably high mountains, through those rolling yellow hills that fall softly to the sea, anything can happen. The trouble is anything has happened, and now something needs to be done, something responsible and responsive, something that begins to approach a sustainable Western economy, together with a trend Barry Lopez invokes, the movement toward a civil society. What I haven't mentioned is beauty. The West is so beautiful in so many places that sometimes you can feel the seams of your heart straining and tearing against it. Beauty is restorative. Much of this beauty resides in the fragility of the West, which makes it as contingent as the noble land itself. Part of that fragility, one of its parents at least, is wildness. And as a region with a broader regional personality that supersedes our individual place personalities, the West, with its frontier past and frontier subconscious, continues to whittle out our character and ineluctably cathect it.
There was two themes that sort of seemed to emerge, and for me anyway, when I read through it again, was that people, in at least in this group of people, they're basically focused on two things, two major themes. The past, coming to terms with what happened in the early days of the West, and the future, how are we going to deal with this problem of water and the environment. So I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition of the past and the present, and it's certainly affecting our lives in the West today.
Just from a emotional, psychological, and even spiritual perspective, each of us as Westerners need to understand and respect the bond that we make with our home. And this is our home now. And what the book really brought home to me was the immense love that everybody who wrote about the West felt, even while we all have complaints. It is our home, and it can't ever be anything but that.
Lynn Stegner divides her time between California and Vermont. Russell Rowland lives in Billings, Montana. Look for more information about them and the book, West of 98, and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, you'll find children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.